Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery, and that is why the Machinery Digest exists, a no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. My friends, and welcome to Idle Chatter from the Hot Rod Farmer, Ray Bohax. Hopefully the sound of my voice finds you healthy, safe, and happy, and that things are going well in your life today. And as I've said before, and as I always tell my wife, that if you're having kind of a bad day today, then I'm quite sure that tomorrow will be much better. And, you know, we need to have those bad days. Not that I wish them upon anyone, and there's certainly nothing that we enjoy when we're going through them. So I don't even want to say a bad day, sometimes a frustrating day, because then when things do go well, we could truly, truly appreciate it. So just remember, very little to nothing grows in a desert, and it's only nice and sunny, and no humidity, but there's no rain there also. So the good Lord uses those rainy days and those times in our life to make us strong and to also have us appreciate when the weather is good, or the metaphorical weather of life is good. But listen, we're going to have a little bit of a different show today. And what I'm basically going to do is not cover a topic, but because I've been going long on the show, and I try to keep it under an hour, like 51, 52 minutes, because the introduction is actually a little bit more than a minute, and within this venue, you need to watch your time. I mean, even though it's not on radio or television, where you have a strict time break, I should say, but also I don't want this to be overbearing and have you listen to it from now until the cows come home. So I've been neglecting some letters that we've had sent into the Hot Rod Farmer, and I want to be able to cover them. So today's show is going to be an entire special delivery show. So I'm not going to talk about a topic at all. I am going to go through, I have three special delivery letters here, and I chose these three because they are eclectic in nature, and I think they would have a lot of value to those of you listening, and also I feel that I could do a very proficient job of bringing some information to you in the allotted time frame. But I want to thank Firestone Ag for sponsoring this entire show today. And as you know, Firestone Ag is a company that was founded by Harvey Firestone, and he was a fourth-generation farmer from Columbiana, Ohio. You know, Harvey always dreamed of putting rubber tires on farm tractors, and his innovative mindset is the core of Firestone Ag today, and lives on with their 23-degree tread bar and AD2 technology. The soil is the lifeblood of your farm. Trust it only to Firestone. And as an aside to that, I hope to be working on right after the new year on the website, farmmachinerydigest.com, a getting to know article about truly understanding the theory and benefits behind the legendary Firestone 23-degree tread bar tire design. So I'm looking forward to being able to expose you guys to that technology so that when you go to buy tires, you can make an intelligent and informed decision. And as I've said before, is that, you know, back east over here, we had many years ago, there was a men's clothier called Cy Sims, and he was a haberdasher. You don't hear that term anymore. And he was quite he advertised quite a bit on television and radio, and his ad tagline used to say, "The educated consumer is my best customer." And that was because Mr. Sims was selling a higher quality level of men's clothes, and he felt that if the, and rightfully so, he believed that if the consumer, his customer, was educated on the, what to look for when buying a suit of clothes, then they would see the value in his product. And As I've said before, I stole Mr. Sims' tagline. I think that he's deceased now. But I stole his tagline. I modified it because I feel that the educated farmer is the most profitable. So when it comes to education, be it in marketing, agronomy, animal husbandry, or in a farm shop in regards to your machinery, education is never lost, and that education allows you to be able to make proper decisions, and those decisions ultimately affect your bottom line. And I'm hoping that as time goes by, that I can really drill that into the audience's mind. And I would like to see you guys out there and gals, the farmers and the farm guys, really pay more attention to things in the farm shop. And I want to make your farm shop and your equipment decisions as efficient and as well thought out as your crop growing or your agronomy or animal husbandry or your marketing decisions. So as I always say, and I, you know, repetition is a way of just getting people to think that way, and that's why I always repeat that. So it's not like it's the only thing I have to say. Trust me, my wife knows that. But I really want you to think that way. And I'm happy to say that in the short period of time that this podcast and website has been up, that I do think that I'm starting to have a minute effect on people, that they're starting to look at things differently. So, and as always, you know, feel free to contact me at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com with any questions, concerns, thoughts, arguments, whatever you want. Disagree with what I say, that's great. Let's open up a dialogue, and I could learn from all of yous. All of you. Yous. That sounds like I'm from New Jersey. I didn't mean to say that. I am from New Jersey. But sounds like I'm from Brooklyn. But anyway, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read the first letter. And the first letter to special delivery today is from Bob, and it appears that he's in Oklahoma. And this is what he writes. "We have several different trucks, cars, and the like on our farm. With rare exception have I seen that whenever cruise control is used, the fuel economy goes down. I am in Oklahoma, so the hills are not mountains, but we do have some long grades. I have asked many people this question over the years, and even mechanics, and they said that should not be. Can you shed any light on this? I love the podcast you do. Thank you, Bob." So let me just reiterate this and just change his words around a little bit. What Bob is asking is that from his experience with an eclectic group of vehicles, farm trucks, you know, semis, cars, pickup trucks, what have you, that whenever he evokes the cruise control, that the majority of time, he says actually with rare exception, he finds that he gets less fuel economy than when he drives the vehicle without the cruise control. And so basically he's saying that the cruise control is actually costing him fuel economy. So I just wanted to clarify that so you could understand. And then what I want to tell you is that that in almost every instance he's 100% correct. And I will explain to you why. That on any vehicle, when you have the cruise control set, what it basically does, it is, it thinks in one, let me put my tongue back in my mouth. What it basically does, it has one goal. That's the word I was looking for. It has one goal, and that goal is to maintain that speed, regardless of what it has to do. Now, the cruise control actually operates the throttle linkage, the throttle pedal, whatever you want to call it, gas pedal, depends upon whether it's a diesel or whether it's on a gasoline motor and whether it's on a carburetor or what have you. years ago with the carbureted gasoline engines, what they had was a vacuum servo, and this vacuum servo would actually physically move the throttle. On today's modern gasoline engines and modern diesels, because modern diesels for the most part do have a throttle, whereas old pump line nozzle diesels did not have a throttle plate, you would actually move the rack in the injection pump. But anyway, so the modern engines do not have a throttle cable. So what they basically do when you have a modern vehicle, modern tractor, car, truck, pickup, whatever, is that actually when you're stepping on the accelerator or gas pedal, whatever you want to call it, the throttle pedal, is that there's a potentiometer under there. And a potentiometer is akin to like a variable resistor. Think of a headlight dimming switch, or think of if you have a dimmer for your dining room lights or what have you, that's basically, think of it as a variable resistor. So it varies the voltage. And a potentiometer, in case you want to know this, is a potentiometer always has three wires, where a variable resistor usually has two wires. So it has the voltage in, it has the voltage output, and some sort of ground. So actually, on a modern application, the gas pedal, the throttle pedal, is actually operating a potentiometer. And a lot of engineering went into the feel of that pedal. So when you were to drive that vehicle, it would have the feel of a traditional gas pedal with a spring and a cable. So there's a lot of engineering went into duplicate that feel and to make the what we would call in engineering, the integration of the technology invisible to the consumer. So you could get into your brand new pickup truck and you're stepping on the gas pedal, and that gas pedal feels as it did years ago for the most part, and that is making it invisible, but there's no cable. And what's actually happening is there's two potentiometers, and it works on a 5-volt signal, and one goes 0 to 5 volts, the other one goes 5 volts to 0. And they compare the two voltages, and that's a redundant circuit for safety. And what happens then is that signal from those two potentiometers, in engineering we call them POTS for short, P-O-T-S. So the signal from those two POTS goes to the engine control computer, and then on the throttle there is actually a little electric motor, and the electric motor opens the throttle plates. So years ago it was vacuum operated, and now today currently it is, whether it's a gasoline or a diesel engine, that usually uses a what they call drive-by-wire, which actually started with aircraft, which was fly-by-wire, and now it's called drive-by-wire for a ground vehicle. So that opens the throttle plates. Now, to get back, it's important that you understand that, because the goal of a cruise control system, be it an older one or a brand new one on a 2019 vehicle to a farm truck, what have you, is to maintain that speed. It's got one goal, and it's going to do whatever it needs to do to maintain that speed. So if you have the cruise control set at 65 miles per hour, and you are running down the road, so Bob is running down the road in Oklahoma, it's relatively flat, and he is going to pull a hill. And the vehicle is starting to pull a hill. And so the cruise control now starts to see the speed drop off, because it uses a vehicle speed sensor. It starts to see the speed drop off, and it starts to open the throttle more. If you are a good driver, you would sense that you're going to have to, and you will do this intuitively, you're going to have to open the throttle too much to try to maintain 65 miles per hour. So you may let the engine stay in its sweet spot and have the speed going up the hill drop down to 62 miles per hour, because you don't want to kick down the transmission or evoke too much throttle. The cruise control does not think that way. If it has to mat that throttle, if it has to floor it to keep that 65 mile per hour speed, it will do that. And so that is one of the reasons why it uses more fuel, is because what it will do is that it will modulate that throttle to, it has one goal in mind, to keep that vehicle speed at what you set it at. Now, as an aside to that, back in the old days, whenever you modulated the throttle, for the most part, you would evoke an accelerator pump shot. So a squirt of fuel from the accelerator pump. On a modern gasoline engine or a modern diesel engine, you do not have an accelerator pump because it's some sort of injection system. But there is something that's called asynchronous injection, which in essence is akin to a fuel injection version of an accelerator pump. And there's synchronous injection and asynchronous injection. And when you have an asynchronous pulse, what means is that there's more fuel injector pulses, gasoline or diesel, than there are ignition pulses. Now, I know diesel doesn't have an ignition. It looks at the crank interrupts. And when it's, so that's acceleration enrichment asynchronous. And then when you release the throttle, then it has more ignition pulses or crank revolutions than fuel injection pulses. And then when it's the throttle is steady state, it's called synchronous. There's an ignition interrupt on a diesel or a ignition pulse on a gasoline engine, and it gives it one shot of fuel. So what's happening with that cruise control is that unless you are a very, very erratic driver where you're in and out of the throttle and you're always evoking those asynchronous pulses, the cruise control is constantly modulating the throttle and is often evoking those asynchronous pulses when they do not need to be triggered. And a good driver will be able to keep the throttle steadier than cruise control. And possibly, let's say you're going on, let's say you're driving in your pickup truck and you're going to pass a semi on the highway. So you move over to the left lane. He's in the right lane, and there's that little bit of extra resistance from the air that the truck is pushing, and you have to brake through that. The cruise control is going to see the speed drop off a mile per hour, and it's going to open the throttle. It's going to give it more fuel, but more importantly, evoking an acceleration enrichment pulse. And you keep doing that over the course of hundreds of miles, is that your fuel economy drops down. So to answer his question, and to bring this full circle and not confuse you with it and make sense of it, is that due to the cruise control having a one mindset, is that what it does is that it does anything it has to evoke different functions of the engine, downshift the transmission, more fuel, more RPM, unlock the torque converter to maintain that speed. Whereas a good driver for who wants to drive for fuel economy will get there just as fast as the cruise control. But he'll feel, hey, you're going up this hill, this thing wants to settle in at 63 miles per hour instead of 64, and then or 65, and then he'll keep the throttle constant, or she'll keep the throttle constant, and the car will go up the hill, or the truck will go up the hill, and then on the way down, you'll release the throttle, and then you'll release the anticipation of the speed climbing from it coasting down the other side of the hill, where the cruise control cannot anticipate anything. It's going to have the throttle, so it's going to come to the top hill, lift the throttle, and then it's going to see the speed drop off, and then it's going to keep going back and forth in what we would call in engineering yo-yoing the throttle plate. But I've ridden with people who are very digital, so in that particular sense that they would get better fuel economy with the cruise control, but you should pride yourself on always being able to beat the cruise control fuel economy, whether it's with a large truck or whether it's a passenger vehicle or what have you. And I have cruise control in my vehicles, and I really hardly ever evoke it. I will evoke it sometimes on a long trip for a couple of miles just so I can move my right leg around and not have to be able to keep that constant pressure. But then after 2 or 3 minutes, I will shut it off and drive the vehicle. So drive the vehicle properly. So in essence, that is the answer to Bob's question. And sadly, other mechanics should have been able to tell you that. And it all comes down to the one thought process and the throttle being oscillated back and forth to maintain that throttle speed and the additional fuel pulses that are evoked during that throttle, what we would call it transitioning the throttle. Alrighty, so that is that. Now we have another question here, and this is from Brian, someplace in Ohio. And He says, I was wondering if you could shed some light on something. I want to buy a new Case IH Patriot sprayer, and I am considering the AIM command option. That's the pulse width, the control option, for those who are not familiar with the Case line. I do not understand about the pulse width system, about being on and off, and the term duty cycle. I do not want to be an engineer, but I would like to know a little bit about the theory of PWM pulse width modulation. So basically, to more succinctly put his question, no disrespect, Brian, he's considering buying a new Case IH Patriot sprayer, which is great. I love when people invest in new equipment on their for their farm. And as I've always said before, remember, it's an investment. It is not a purchase. You're not spending money. You know, you're not spending money. And, you know, akin, and as an aside to that, you know, if you deal with a banker or something, if you go say, I want to buy a new sprayer, you know, in their world, buy is spending money. When you want to invest in something, that means you're looking for a return. You're not looking just for to pay for itself. You're looking for a return. So when you so Brian is looking to invest in a new Case IH sprayer, and I think that is great because whenever you could bring efficiencies to your farm, then that is definitely going to help your bottom line. And he wants to understand the pulse width modulated circuit. And this is going to be a little bit longer of an explanation, but I'm going to simplify it as much as I can, and I can make it very, very simple. Basically, in essence, a pulse width modulated circuit, or PWM, is a duty cycle. And what a duty cycle means is that the circuit is turned on and off. And what happens is that there are two main components to any pulse width modulated circuit. And one is a very fast acting solenoid, and the key word is fast acting, the operative words there. And the other thing is the ECU, or the brain, to control it. And obviously there's wires and there's in between those two. And then, so what basically happens is that the ECU is an information gathering device, and it's going to have sensor inputs, and then it's going to make a decision. And in this particular instance, it's a spray decision to turn on a spray tip. And then what's going to happen is that inside the ECU, there is something that's called a driver, D-R-I-V-E-R. And what a driver is, you could consider it an electronic switch with no moving parts, or you want to consider an electronic relay with no moving parts. So it has no moving parts. It's all done with circuitry. And what the driver does is the ECU says, okay, we need to operate this circuit. And so it actually, and most times when you have a pulse width modulated circuit, the driver controls the ground side of the circuit. That's very important for you to understand that if you ever have a circuit like this and you want to diagnose it, is that it's what we call battery looking for ground. So it would be, in this instance, 12 volts, and the 12 volts would always be going out, and then the driver is on the ground side. So think of it like, you know, in the old TV shows, you should see Morse code there, tick, 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 and he'd be making a contact with a little switch, and he'd move it up and down like a stapler, and so long and short pulses. That is exactly what a pulse width modulated circuit is. It's a digital circuit, digital meaning on and off. The term analog means that it's a varying voltage, and digital means that the signal is turned on and it's turned off. And what will happen is the driver will control the ground. When the ground path is completed, the solenoid will be energized, and in this particular instance will be open and allow the on a sprayer, allow it to pass whatever is in the spray tank to the nozzle tip. Okay. We just had a question about cruise control, and fuel injector is a pulse width modulated circuit. So that's basically, in essence, it's the same thing. It works the same way. It's duty cycled, opened and closed. But what often gets confusing, so that concept of the duty cycle being turned on and off is relatively easy to understand, and most people could grasp that without much issue. The thing that comes into play is that there's a third component here, and the third component is the frequency of the duty cycle. And the term hertz, H-E-R-T-Z, is a term that measures how many cycles per second. And this is, so the first two parts of the turning the circuit on and off, okay, you know, we'll go over here, we're going to turn the sprayer tip on, that's going to spray it, and how does it alter that? It alters that through the ground, but there is another element, and that's where people get confused. So it's hertz. Hertz is cycles per second, and in electronics, cycles per second means how many times it gets turned on and shut off. And probably the first app, now pulse width modulated circuits and controls have been around for many years, but the first application that I'm cognizant of, other than an electronic fuel injector, and that's a little bit different, still a pulse width circuit, but it's usually not a fixed hertz signal, so we're not going to go there, was back in the early 1980s, 1981, when General Motors came out with what people would call in the vernacular the electronic carburetor. And it had a mixture control solenoid that actually duty cycled and moved up and down the metering rods in the carburetor to control the mixture. And I used to teach this. And this is, and I'm going to use the same explanation that I used to use many years ago when I taught this for General Motors computer command control carburetors. So most duty cycles, most, not all, most, and I believe that the Case IH Patriot system is the same as the General Motors carburetor was, works on a 10 hertz signal. That means 10 cycles per second. So now, let's not think about it as cycles per second, because that's very confusing. So let's think of it of cycles per hour, because that's easier for you to grasp than cycles per second. Whenever you're trying to think about something or understand the technology, you know, move the decimal point over, bring it into something larger, because if it's too small, it's very hard for the human mind to comprehend that, and you don't grasp the subject, and you get confused. So how many cycles, how can I do 10 times per second? Whatever, I can't see that, I can't measure that. You know what I'm saying? But you can measure time in hours, right? So let's, this was basically the example that I used to give in my class teaching General Motors computer command control. And I'm going to modify it slightly. The two locations I'm going to modify slightly for the agricultural community. So let's say that you're hauling grain from the bin to the grain elevator. And you have a young guy who's driving the truck. And what happens is that you tell him, and we'll say it's Ray, and say, Ray, you have to make 10 trips per hour to the grain elevator. So from the bin to the grain elevator. That's what I'm going to pay you for 10 trips per hour. You can get paid by the trip, and you need to make 10 trips per hour. Not 11, not 8, 10 trips per hour. All right, so 10 trips per hour, that's our hertz. Instead of cycles per second, we're saying 10 cycles per second, we're going to do 10 trips per hour. So now, at the grain elevator, there's this very pretty girl working. And Ray, the driver, was really interested in her. He's a young guy, she's a young girl, very pretty girl. And then at the bin on the farm, there's this grizzled old guy that's helping him load the grain. So what Ray does is he says to himself, well, I have to make 10 trips per hour, right? That's what the boss says. I have to make 10 trips per hour, but I really don't want to spend a lot of time with this grizzled old man at the bin loading the truck, so I'm going to load the truck very quickly, and I'm going to drive very fast over to the elevator, and then I could spend more time talking to the pretty girl as the truck is being unloaded. And then when I get done with that, I'm going to drive very quickly back to the grain bin and load the truck quickly so I could spend more time with the girl. But I'm still going to make 10 trips per hour, but he's going to spend more time at the grain elevator with the pretty girl than he is going to spend at the bin at the farm with the grizzled old man. All right? 10 trips per hour, So 10 hertz, 10 cycles per second. So now, let's say the next day, the girl is now working at the farm at the bin. How that would happen, I have no idea, but stay with me on this. And the grizzled old man is at the grain elevator. So now what happens is that Ray wants to spend more time at the farm, all right, than he does at the grain elevator, so because he wants to talk to the girl. So what he does is that he still needs to make 10 trips per hour, but what he does is he'll load very slowly at the grain at the farm, and then dump very quick at the grain elevator and run back. All right, so he's still making 10 trips per hour, but what he's controlling is where he's spending the majority of time. And the word duty cycle comes into play. So duty cycle means the length of time on a pulse width modulated circuit that it is open, that the 12 volts is seeing ground through the driver and the solenoid is energized. So if you have a 50% duty cycle, that means that the solenoid is open 50% of the time and closed 50% of the time, but still making 10 trips per second, 10 hertz. So now the grizzled old man leaves, and now there's a pretty girl at the farm, and there's a pretty girl at the grain elevator. So what happens is that now the truck driver, Ray, spends 50% of his time at the farm and 50% time at the grain elevator because he wants to be able to talk to both pretty girls. If the next day they change the girl at the farm, and she's pretty, but not as pretty as the other girl, he may spend 30% of his time at the grain elevator, at the farm, and 70% of the time at the grain elevator. So that is your duty cycle. So if you consider the grain elevator when the solenoid is open and passing, in this particular point, the sprayer, the whatever is in the spray tank, and he spends 70% of its time open, then that would be a 70% duty cycle. And if it's the inverse, then it would be a 30% duty cycle. So now to apply this is that there is a couple of things you have to keep in mind. Is that the pulse width modulated circuit is being turned on and off like Morse code, tick, 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 tick. It's going to have a fixed frequency, a fixed hertz, and I believe that the Case IH system is a 10 hertz signal like a General Motors mixture control solenoid used to be. So it's 10 cycles per second, and if you want to put more product down, so you want more product coming out of that spray tip, then the duty cycle will be longer. And 100% duty cycle means that it is no longer cycling. It's no longer making 10 trips per second. It's staying completely open. And 0% duty cycle means it's completely closed. So that is a very simplistic way to think about it. The hertz is 10 times per second, how many trips it has to make, and then what you need to do is what you are controlling. So if you're coming, let's say, to the end rows, and the GPS says that you're on the end rows, what it's going to do is the system is going to shut off the injector, 0% duty cycle, and the injector is going to be closed, and then once you make that turn, or maybe 3% or something, 5%, what have you, that means it's 97% closed, it's only open 3% of the time, and then you make that turn, and then you're going back into the field, and the GPS system sees that, and we want to put 30 gallons per acre on, and based upon the mathematics of the flow, the pressure, and the flow, it's going to adjust the length of time that solenoid is open and allowing fluid to pass. I'm saying fuel because I'm talking fuel injector. And you'll keep in mind that that's exactly how a fuel injector works on a gasoline or diesel engine. So it is a duty cycle. So what you really need to be concerned with is understanding to recap this and make make sense out of it is that there is going to be a hertz signal, how many cycles per second, and then the pulse width is read in milliseconds, which is thousandths of a second. So if you say that you have a 1.6 milliseconds, that means it's open for 1.6 thousandths of a second. Not 1.6 seconds, 1.6 thousandths of a second. And then the duty cycle is basically another way of looking at that. It's the length of time that it is opened and not closed. So that is the basis of a pulse width modulated circuit. So too, now there's other sprayers obviously that are incorporating other systems, retrofit systems that work on pulse width modulated technology, and I have to say that it is a wonderful, wonderful technology. It is not overly complicated. The inputs are complicated for it to make the right decision, but basically it's a driver and a fast acting solenoid. And if the solenoid is responding properly, then it gives excellent, excellent control over whatever you're trying to do. But it is something that you have to keep in mind is that the weak link in those systems historically are that the solenoid could either get mechanically lazy, so it's not returning or it's not either opening fast enough because the magnetics got lazy, and it's what they call a very slow rise time, or if it gets gummed up or the spring inside, because it's an electromagnet working against a spring. When the ground path is completed through the driver, the solenoid lifts up and opens up a pintle or a valve, what have you, depending upon the system, and allows the liquid to pass, and then when you remove the ground, it's spring loaded closed. So they do get lazy over time, and depending upon the design of the circuitry and what protection the manufacturer put in it, they're usually pretty good today. Back years ago, they were not in the auto industry. Is that if that solenoid becomes shorted, it has the opportunity to actually take out the driver, because it's based upon, like on an old GM system, it was based upon 25 ohms of resistance, and if the circuit becomes shorted, what it basically does is flows too much current and burns out the driver. But, you know, I don't want to spook you with that. Don't be frightened with that. The weak link right now basically would be that if the solenoid gets lazy and doesn't want to respond fast enough, but that's years from now if you take care of it. So hopefully that you have a little bit better understanding of the pulse width modulated circuit and how it's controlled, and in essence it's the length of time that the ground is on and the solenoid is open, and that's either on a fuel injector or on a sprayer or what have you. An excellent, excellent system. And just think of when you think of the grain elevator corn bin story, and wherever you want to spend more time, but you still have to make so many trips per hour. So when it comes to something like that, always multiply it out. Make it an hour instead of a second, and then it becomes very, very easy to grasp and understand. The last question that I have today is from Steve in Georgia. And he says, there is a lot of talk about tire pressure and soil compaction. The problem being, what tire pressure should I run on my tractors and other equipment? The owner's manual gives a range. It is very confusing. Thank you so much. Well, this is going to be very, very simple. Is that first what you need to do is you need to get a load, tire load calculation literature book, and but in essence, the industry has a standard, so the Tire and Wheel Association has a standard, and that's what weight that tire could hold at what pressure. And I know that Firestone has an excellent booklet that they give away for free that has all of the tire sizes. And I do want to, you know, establish this, that if you go to a Firestone dealer and ask them, you could go on their website actually, and you could see that and print it out, or you could just go on Firestone, I think FirestoneAg.com. If you go to my website, there's a link to it, Farm Machinery Digest, and .com, and then you could go get the load, well, I call them load tables, I think they call them something else, and that's industry standard. So even though you could use the Firestone data because it's from the Tire and Wheel Association, even if you have a Michelin tire or a Goodyear Titan tire or what have you, that's industry standard. Just like 9/16 bolt is industry standard, 14 millimeter bolt. So And what you need to do is you need to look at how much weight that tire could hold at a given pressure. And the whole idea in simplistic terms is that you want to be able to use as much of that tread bar to contact that soil. Because if you have more of the tread bar, and that's going to be influenced by the weight of the machine and the weight of the load it's carrying and also the tire pressure. So it's a combination of what we would call in engineering degrees of freedom. There's three different variables, three different things that you could adjust. So the idea is to have the most tread touching that soil, because if you have the most tread touching that soil, then the amount of weight per given area, whether you want to say square inch, square centimeter, what have you, is going to be less. If you only have a little bit of tread touching it because you have the wrong inflation in the tire pressure, then that's going to impact the compaction and the amount of tread. But now also keep in mind that when you are actually have the air in the tire, it's actually lifting, a lot of the weight off the tread. And it's lifting it up and keeping it suspended. So that is why it's a combination of the weight and the air pressure, because you want to be able to suspend that weight and have the air hold that weight off of that tire, for simplistic terms, and also you want to have enough air for the weight so the tread bar is completely touching the soil. To answer your question, Steve, this is very simple, but what you're going to need to do, and this is the only accurate way that you could do it, is you're going to need to talk to your tire dealer. I know that Firestone tire dealers do this, and I'm sure other dealers do also, in all fairness, is that you need to have a relationship with your tire dealer, and you need to have him come to your farm or bring your equipment to him. It's usually best for them to come to your farm, or they'll actually lend it to you, and they will lend you scales. And what you need to do is, we're going to use a tractor for simplicity's sake. So you're going to need to put this tractor, drive it up onto the four scales. It'll be just like we used to set up race cars that way. The only thing, these scales are heavier, you can hold more weight. Is that what you need to do is drive the tractor onto the scales, and then you're going to say, okay, for this size tire, and for this weight per axle, and the scales, you could read a display and see how much it weighs, I need to have 18 pounds of air, making up a number, all right, 18 pounds of air. So when, and you look in that load book and said, for you to have the proper proper tread contact pattern, tread bar contact pattern, and support this weight, for this weight you need 18 pounds of air. So now what you do is you take a notebook and you write down, say, tractor by itself, 18 pounds of air. So now what you do is you go and you hook up your planter. Because what is going to happen is that even though you have a pull-along planter, it's not on a three-point hitch or what have you, you're going, and that's why you need the scales, you're going to affect the weight distribution on that tractor. So now you hook up the planter and you drive back onto the scales. And what you may end up doing, depending upon how much road time you do with that tractor, you may have the planter lifted up and now read the scales and looking back into that load book and say, okay, when I have the planter in transport mode, I need to have, I'm throwing numbers, 22 pounds of air in the rear tires and 18 pounds in the front tires. And then what you do is you'll put that planter down, and then you'll see how the scale, how the weight distribution changes. And then you'll say, okay, and you write that down, and then you'll say, alrighty, when I have the planter down, and ideally you should try to simulate the load that the planter would have with the fertilizer in it and with the seed, if possible, or close to it, and say, okay, with the planter down, I need to have 21 pounds in the front and 19 pounds in the back. And then you would do this with all your equipment. It's really a great winter project. It is not hard. It's tedious because you're going to be going on and off the scales, and you're going to be hooking up the piece of equipment, and you say, okay, I got the grain cart. What should I do with this, and what have you? And you could do this with all of your equipment, and most tire dealers, and I know that, like I said again, because I actually went to an excellent class on this for Firestone. It was in upstate New York, and Brad Harris, the engineer from Firestone, went through all this, and we actually was at a of Massey Ferguson Steiger dealer, and we actually took a tractor and we hooked up a hay rake to it, and we hooked up something else to it, and we just documented all of this. And once you write this down in a book, once you write it down in a notebook, you say, okay, I'm going to field cultivate. With the field cultivator, I need to have X amount of pounds in the front tires, X amount of pounds in the rear tires, and then you have it written down and you go from there. And it's a one-shot deal unless you change something. And it'd be based upon the tire size that is on the tractor. So to recap this, to make it easy for you to understand, is that don't feel confused, Steve, in Georgia, because the booklet gives you a range, but the missing link is you don't know what the load is on that tire. And the only accurate way for you to do this is to borrow the scales, write it down. And once you borrow the scales, unless you got a new piece of equipment, then you don't, that doesn't change. I mean, unless you change the tire size, so that doesn't change. So the thing basically is it's a one-time deal, and most tire dealers have scales, and lots of times they'll actually come and send a technician to work with you on it. It's not as time-consuming as it first appears, as long as you do some homework and say, okay, you know, I want to hook up the planter, I want to hook up this whatever sprayer, if you have a pull-along sprayer, I want to hook up the field cultivator, whatever it may be, and have that all easily accessible. Then you drive onto the scales, and you do this with your sprayer also. And if you have a self-propelled sprayer or anything else, you could do this with your combine. So the fact of the matter is that you could do this with anything, as long as the scales could take that weight. But it's very, very important. I commend you on that, because the soil is the lifeblood of your farm, and if you go and you have the wrong tire pressure, you're actually compacting that soil to a much greater extent and not getting the full benefit of that tire. And I strongly suggest that everyone heeds this advice, and like I say, it's a great winter time if your farm shop is big enough to pull all the equipment in and drive it up on scales, and it's actually put the music, hey, put my podcast on and listen to that, right? I mean, put the music on. It's no big deal, because it's more tedious driving on and off the scales and then, looking in the book and just assigning the air pressure for that load and for that tire size. So listen, it's Thanksgiving week, and I want to wish you all a blessed, blessed, blessed Thanksgiving. And I know that, for a lot of you that, the times are financially hard, and I understand that and I respect that. And I think that's probably throughout the agriculture sector, and as good as the economy is, there's always somebody that's going to be suffering, right? I mean, even in Beverly Hills, there's poor people, and I don't mean that you're poor, but I want to just leave you with this one last thought, is that, look around and be so grateful for what you have. If you have your health, you have your family, you have your farm, you're able to, God has blessed you in so many ways. And, getting back to my original opening statement that if nothing ever grows in the desert, and the thing is that, if you are grateful for everything that you have, then whatever you have is always enough. And I think that if you really do apply that metric and look at it in your life, is that, you have a roof over your head, you're farming, you're ranching, you're doing what you love, you're feeding the world. It's probably the most noble profession out there. You're living out near God's creation, and, things are great. There's a lot of things to be grateful for, and I would rather recognize that. And once you recognize that and see that, you will change your mindset. And I'm not saying everyone is that way, but so often in life, and not just in agriculture, in every aspect of business, you get together with the family for Thanksgiving, and you have some guy who works in town, and he says, oh, the mill is slow, and I'm not taking anything away from that, but we really need to put this in perspective, and we need to know that, the good Lord is very merciful, and we need to be thankful for what we have. And there's plenty of people that are in the hospital that have someone that's dying, or a person that's paralyzed, or a young soldier that came back from the war with his legs blown off, and don't tell him that corn dropped 2 cents. So And like I say, I'm repeating, I'm not making light of it, but I'm very grateful for you. I'm very grateful for the blessings that I have in my life. And is everything the way I wanted it to be or hoped it would be? No. But I'm healthy. I'm happy. I have a lovely wife, and we have a farm, and it's just so many blessings, and I just want to convey that to you. And also, please look. I will be doing my special podcast, and that'll be up hopefully later this week. And that is what to get the hot rod farmer in your life for Christmas. So check that out, and that'll be on the Fran Network along with this podcast, and also on Ag Daily. So you have a blessed, blessed day. Have a blessed, blessed Thanksgiving, and thank you so much for listening. And I will talk to you next week. Bye bye.